Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History, by Richard Thompson Ford. Narrated by Bill Andrew Quinn. Fashion is an instant language. Miuccia Prada. Introduction. According to the January 16, 1797 edition of the Times of London, John Hetherington, haberdasher of the Strand, was arraigned on a charge of breach of the peace and inciting to riot and required to post bond in the amount of £500 for the following offense. It was in evidence that Mr. Hetherington appeared on the public highway, wearing upon his head what he called a silk hat, which was offered into evidence, a tall structure having a shining luster and calculated to frighten timid people. As a matter of fact, the officers of the Crown stated that several women fainted at the unusual sight, while children screamed, dogs yelped, and a young man was thrown down by the crowd which had collected and had his right arm broken. For these reasons, the defendant was seized by the guards and taken before the Lord Mayor. What rule, written or implied, but apparently known to all, even dogs, did Mr. Hetherington and his headwear violate? Tall cylindrical hats were common well before the late 18th century. For instance, the Puritans of the mid-17th century wore a severe black felt hat that is now familiar to every American school child as the headwear of the Mayflower Pilgrims. And a scant 30 years after Mr. Hetherington's arrest, the top hat had become an avatar of the staid and self-satisfied plutocrat, marketed with names such as the D'Orsay, the Wellington, and the Regent. What now obscure coat allowed a top hat to be read as a provocation, calculated to frighten and deserving of legal sanction? Unfortunately, we can only speculate. The surviving record of the case begins and ends with this brief newspaper column. It wasn't the first time a hat caused a riot and wouldn't be the last. For instance, during the notorious Straw Hat Riot of 1922, marauding gangs in New York City violently enforced the rule that no man should wear a straw hat after September 15th, knocking offending headwear off of the heads of passers-by, stomping on the hats and impaling them on pikes. The riots engulfed the city from the Bronx to the Battery. Over 1,000 would-be fashion police gathered uptown on Amsterdam Avenue attacking straw-hatted bystanders, while downtown, fights between the vigilantes and citizens who attempted to defend their hats stopped traffic on the Manhattan Bridge. One might think that such sartorial strictures and prescriptions are largely things of the past. The once ubiquitous suit and tie, to say nothing of the dressy hat, are almost historical costume. But while dress codes may seem like a throwback, if anything, they are growing more and more popular. For instance, in 1999 to 2000, 46.7% of U.S. public schools enforced a strict dress code. By 2013 to 2014, 58.5% did. Millions of people must conform to a dress code every day at work or school, and millions more confront dress codes after hours in restaurants, nightclubs, and theaters. Even the relaxed bohemian domain of the American coffee shop is governed by dress codes. The Starbucks barista must eschew unnatural hair colors, nail polish, short skirts, and piercings other than earrings and subtle nose studs. No septum rings allowed. And dress codes aren't just for school-age kids and image-conscious private businesses. They are in force on the public streets, where clothing deemed provocative or threatening may be against the law. Those sagging pants favored by some rappers and their fans could be grounds for arrest in certain cities, and if police decide they mark you as a member of a gang, they could even turn a minor crime into a capital offense. Some dress codes not only prescribe and prohibit specific garments, but also obsessively dictate the minutiae of attire. Consider the 2010 dress code of the United Bank of Switzerland, a 44-page tome that directs employees to avoid chipped nail polish and scuffed shoes, make sure that jewelry matches the metallic color of eyeglasses, and that neckties just touch the tops of belt buckles. Exacting rules and detailed rules about what to wear are everywhere. For example, in 2010, the Wall Street Journal advised that Your black tie attire should consist of the following foundational components. A black single-button, single-breasted jacket with a peak lapel. The points of the lapel points should point upward, whereas they point down on a regular suit. And trousers that have a silk stripe or braiding running along the outside seam of the leg. Your shirt should be of white marcella, a cotton that is starchier than that used in regular shirts, with a bib front. French cuffs are a must, and a regular fold-down collar, as opposed to the smaller flapped winged collar, is the purist's choice. The bow tie is the recommended choice, and learn to tie it. A cummerbund, the fancy waistband, is also de rigueur, and make sure the pleats are facing upward. The shoes, patent leather Oxfords, are the classic, but a pair of well-polished regular Oxfords could do. How can you express your personal style in such a rigid uniform? Your pocket square, cufflinks, watch, which should match your cufflinks, and good manners. And even after following such detailed guidelines, you can still get it wrong. According to the men's style blog, The Art of Manliness, when attending a black tie affair, the implication that you would check the time is considered rude to the hosts. In other words, when worn with a black tie ensemble, a watch, even one that matches one's cufflinks, is inappropriate. And yet the typical black tie soiree is a come-as-you-are shindig compared to a day at the races at the Royal Enclosure at Ascot, where ladies are kindly reminded that dresses and skirts should be of modest length defined as falling just above the knee or longer. Dresses and tops should have straps of 1 inch or greater. Trouser suits are welcome. They should be of full length and of matching material and color. Hats should be worn. However, a headpiece which has a base of 4 inches, 10 centimeters, or more in diameter is acceptable as an alternative to a hat. Strapless, off-the-shoulder, halter neck, and spaghetti straps are not permitted. Midriffs must be covered. Fascinators are not permitted. Neither are headpieces, which do not have base covering a sufficient area of the head, 4 inches, 10 centimeters. As for men, even an immaculately correct dinner suit ensemble, watch left safely behind at home, would be out of place at Ascot, where it is a requirement to wear either black or gray morning dress, which must include a waistcoat and tie, no cravats, a black or gray top hat, black shoes. A gentleman may remove his top hat within a restaurant, a private box, a private club, or that facility's terrace, balcony, or garden. Hats may also be removed within any enclosed external seating area within the Royal Enclosure Garden. The customization of top hats, with, for example, colored ribbons or bands, is not permitted in the Royal Enclosure. Such nitpicking isn't limited to unusually fastidious businesses and old-fashioned festivities. When I asked Kate Lampshire, then the editor-in-chief of Marie Claire magazine and a self-described punk rock girl, about today's dress codes, she pointed out that even oppositional subcultures that pride themselves on breaking all of the rules still follow a code. The patches you put on a denim jacket or the pens, the band T-shirt you're wearing is still a code to other people to identify with. They're saying, "I'm part of this tribe." They're following the code of the rule breakers. In other words, those rule breakers replace the old rules with new rules, often just as uncompromising as those they just broke. Here I am reminded of the Pinnacle Peak Steakhouse in Southern California, known for its large portions and rustic atmosphere, where employees wielding scissors cut off the neckties of unsuspecting businessmen. The workaday rule requiring neckties is replaced by an after-hours rule forbidding them. Similarly, free-spirited college students who blanch at the idea of a dress code imposed by university administrators seem happy to conform to intricate unwritten rules about attire. Campus social cliques are readily identified by their shared style of dress, and the fashions of just a few years ago are as completely absent as if they had been prohibited by law. Their professors, for their part, advertise their disdain for surface appearance with a dishevelment that has become a kind of academic credential. The naive assistant professor who wears a Dolce & Gabbana dress to a faculty meeting may need years to recover an aura of scholarly gravitas. Even the Silicon Valley style of casual wear has become a kind of dress code. If a sweatshirt and flip-flops demonstrates a single-minded focus on innovation, a suit and tie betray an outmoded concern with appearances and status. Accordingly, one Northern California investor advised, "Never invest in a tech CEO that wears a suit." These unwritten dress codes can be as powerful as rules inscribed in law and enforced by police. A different kind of dress code gives our clothing social meaning. It is said that it takes about 3 seconds to make a first impression. What you wear is one of the most important parts of that introductory image. Clothing can magnify and embellish natural differences and can make the abstract statuses of social hierarchy tangible. The European aristocrat and blue-blooded New England preppy are defined by the subtleties of dress as much as by wealth and family lineage. Gender difference is marked by clothing, hairstyles, and cosmetics. Racial and ethnic groups maintain the bonds of kinship and solidarity through distinctive grooming and attire. Even religious faith, often thought of as a matter of private belief, is given public significance by prescribed and forbidden dress and grooming. And we don't just dress to impress others. Our attire reflects our deepest commitments, aspirations, and sense of self. People often refer to a favorite item of clothing as a signature. What we choose to wear can be as personal as our name. Yet we often take these most conspicuous elements of social standing and personal distinction for granted. Why is attire so rule-bound? Why and when is clothing important enough to become the subject of treatises, rules and regulations, legislative proclamations, and judicial edicts? What happens, and what should happen, when those rules come into conflict with changing social norms about equality and personal freedom? When do dress codes serve useful purposes, and when are they needlessly repressive or unjust? What does it mean to dress for success or to flout the rules in the interest of self-expression? Is our choice of attire ever really personal, or do we always dress to impress or provoke other people? Are rules about clothing less important in the era of telecommuting and online dating, or have our less frequent face-to-face interactions become all the more loaded with meaning? Dress codes will answer these questions and many others, exploring the laws of fashion throughout history to uncover the personal, social, and political significance of clothing, our most intimate and most public medium of self-expression. Decoding dress, communication, and self-fashioning. Like a lot of men, I inherited whatever sense of style I have from my father. He was a man of rigorous and refined sartorial sensibilities, a trained tailor, a scholar, activist, and ordained minister. For years, my dad endured my sartorial misadventures, asymmetrical new-wave haircuts, nylon parachute pants, the punk look, which consisted of deliberately torn garments held together with safety pins or duct tape, in quiet despair. It is said that the boy is father to the man, but, at least in this case, it turned out the father was the father. At long last, I followed my dad's lead. I came to appreciate the virtues of well-cut tailored clothing, polished dress shoes, crisp shirts, even, on occasion, a necktie. Though life in early 21st century Northern California rarely calls for one. I learned how to tie a half and full Windsor and a four-in-hand knot, and how to tie a bow tie. This last a skill needed only for rare black tie events, but, my dad insisted, worth mastering because, when the time comes, you won't be stuck wearing one of those ridiculous clip-ons. I learned how to tell the difference between a jacket properly constructed with a floating canvas and one that is fused, glued together, my dad would grumble. Most of all, I learned that clothing could be both a form of self-constitution and a medium of communication, and how attire communicates respect or disdain, purpose or aimlessness, seriousness or frivolity. This combination of personal significance and social meaning explains why governments, businesses, and the institutions of civil society regulate attire, and why individuals often consider such regulations oppressive and insulting. My father had died 12 years before I decided to enter Esquire magazine's Best Dressed Real Man contest in 2009. My circumstances at the time will be familiar to any new parent. My second child was 10 months old, and my wife Marlene and I hadn't been out to dinner or movie in as many months. Our aspirations to a glamorous and urbane existence a faded memory. Our fashionable, or at least serviceable, festive attire pushed aside to make room for a slew of cotton onesies and bright plastic baby toys. Our feeble attempts at grown-up merrymaking reduced to cocktails hastily mixed in the kitchen and between bottle feedings and diaper changes. One day after work, I decided it would be a welcome change of pace to enter the Esquire contest and rally our friends to support my quixotic campaign. Harried 43-year-old dad versus a bevy of lantern-jawed aspiring actors, sinewy fashion models, and athletic-looking frat boys. David against Adonis. The entry deadline was the next day. Arlene got out the camera and snapped a series of pictures. My 5-year-old son Cole explored my stack of old magazines, while 10-month-old Ella did everything she could to get her parents' attention. A few minutes later, with Ella screaming for a bottle or a diaper change, we called it quits. I uploaded the snapshots, filled out a short questionnaire, and hit send. Then I scoped out the competition. Other contestants had professional photos shot in exotic locations with exquisite backlighting. Some had already amassed tens of thousands of votes. I was hoping to break into triple digits. Several weeks later, the website posted the top 25 semifinalists, and, to my astonishment, there were the photos of me holding a squirming toddler while trying to show a favorite blue pinstripe suit to its best effect. It couldn't be right. I refreshed the browser and waited for the real list of semifinalists to appear. I was still there. A few days later, I got a call on my mobile phone. Esquire had narrowed the field to 10, who they were now interviewing in order to select 5 finalists who would fly to New York, receive fabulous prizes, and appear on the Today Show. They wanted to talk to me about my personal style. How did I choose what to wear? Could I be more specific? What tips would I offer others? Be yourself isn't very helpful, is it? Why was style important to me? Who were my style inspirations? Come on, everyone says their father. Who else? Everyone says Cary Grant. Everyone says Miles Davis, too. David Bowie. That's better. Which era? Let's Dance? Really? A few days later, the editor called again to break the bad news. I was number 6, just short of the cutoff for finalists. It was all great fun, but also humbling. Talking about my personal style should have been easy. I am a professor, someone who explains things to people for a living, but I blew the interview. I knew intuitively why I wore what I did, but I could not explain it to save my life or my chances at a fabulous, all-expense-paid weekend in New York City. My dad's guidance had, against all odds, helped me into the top 10, but he couldn't help me decrypt the inscrutable codes of dress. In a sense, this book is my response in L'Esprit d'Escalier. In it, I will explore dress codes antique and contemporary, medieval sumptuary laws and modern indecency statutes, Renaissance vestimentary norms and Victorian-era sartorial etiquette, the sartorial rules of the road and of the street, workplace and school. To understand why we care so much about what we, and other people, wear, I had to look at how clothing and fashion shape our behavior and perception of the world. That's not always easy to do because the way clothing affects our social interactions and worldview is a matter of habit, so reflexive and deeply ingrained that we don't even notice it. Of course, we do notice the multi-billion-dollar fashion industry dedicated to offering us an array of fashions to choose from, the styles that change every few months, the fashion magazines and newspaper columns that report on the latest trends, the stories full of clothes, and, of course, all of those dress codes, rules, and expectations around clothing. But all of this ever-changing detail, as overwhelming as it can seem, is just a small part of the world of fashion, like an eye-catching appliqué on top of a jacket. We're immersed in these details, but we rarely question or analyze the larger patterns of dress. For instance, what makes some fashions masculine and others feminine? Why are some garments considered bold or edgy and others conservative or demure? What makes high heels frivolously sexy and flat shoes sensible but boring? We make small decisions about the fit, cut, and embellishments of our clothing, but almost no one questions its basic design. 2,000 years ago, a politician would have worn draped garment, what we today might call a toga when going to discuss affairs of state. The political leaders and elites of 700 years ago still wore draped robes not so different than the ancient toga. But most of today's politicians wear tailored trousers, the garb of the barbarian or the peasant to the ancients, and a matching longish jacket with lapels, the business suit. Why and when did this change take place? No one would dream of wearing a robe or a toga to an important meeting, but many women in more tradition-bound professions still eschew pants in favor of a dress or skirt, both essentially draped garments descended from the ancient toga. We take all of this and much more for granted. These larger and more long-lived trends in fashion organize society and shape how we think about ourselves. They are often the subject of explicit rules, dress codes, that determine both what clothing means and when and by whom it may be worn. We need to look at changes in fashion over a long period of time, not seasons, years, or even decades, but centuries, in order to see these larger trends. Looking at the rules that codified these changes alongside the historical events of the time helped me to understand what fashion meant then and what it means for us today. I learned that fashion is much more than just clothes. It performs two important functions, communications and self-constitution. Fashion is a way of communicating ideas, values, and aspirations through clothes. Through our attire, we announce who we are, what we care about, and where we belong, or aspire to belong, in society. Sometimes the message is obvious and direct, like the way an officer's uniform conveys authority. Other times more inchoate and figurative, like the way a punk rock girl's denim jacket covered with patches and pins conveys rebellious swagger. Less obviously, but perhaps more importantly, fashion is a mean of transforming our sense of self and our sense of our place in society, what I will call, borrowing from the historian Stephen Greenblatt, self-fashioning. Attire can also change our self-perception and affect our learning, development, and sense of possibility. In a sense, we become what we dress for. Our clothing trains us to occupy a social role, giving us confidence or sapping our courage, straightening our posture or forcing us to slouch, offering a sense of physical comfort and support or of constraint and irritation. In this respect, in contradiction to the old saying, clothes actually do make the man or woman, and they've long helped to establish the difference. Our clothing becomes a part of our bodies, both reflecting and shaping our personalities and helping us fit into various social roles, or making it hard for us to do so. An obvious example of this is women's clothing in the mid-1800s, which consisted of large full skirts, frills, and bone corsets. These outfits not only sent the message that women were decorative objects, valuable mainly for their beauty, they also made it impossible for women to move around easily or quickly, and harder for them to perform many types of physical tasks, which in turn served as a visual evidence that women were less competent than men. Most women internalized the dress codes of the time and only felt comfortable in such clothing. This in turn led some to think of themselves as helpless and fundamentally decorative. Their clothing determined their social roles and ultimately their sense of self. Here's another example of the self-fashioning power of clothing. Psychological studies in 2012 and 2015 found that people who wore a white lab coat or dressed up for a job interview exhibited better abstract reasoning than people of comparable intelligence wearing jeans and t-shirts. Dress codes are key pieces of evidence about both of these social functions of attire, communication and self-fashioning. Dress code has a double meaning. A code is a rule regulating action or behavior, such as law, but a code is also a rule or a formula for interpreting or deciphering text. So, a dress code is a rule or law regulating how we dress and also a rule controlling the meaning of our attire. In 1967, the semiologist Roland Barthes used the explicit discussions of clothing in high fashion magazines as a guide to understand more mundane, day-to-day attire. He found that almost every detail of an ensemble, shirt collar, skirt length, color, pattern, fabric, could express passions, aspirations, fantasies, and convictions. The fashion magazine offered an incomplete lexicon of vestimentary meaning. It was at once a description of existing fashionable practices and a prescription for refining and improving them. I have a similar ambition for the study of dress codes. Dress codes simplify the often overwhelming complexity of vestimentary custom because they take the form of rules. Because it must be specific in its prescriptions and prohibitions, a dress code, like fashion writing, makes the often implicit and unconscious meaning of attire explicit and deliberate. When a dress code requires or forbids an item of attire, it implies something of its social meaning. A dress code that excludes unprofessional attire simultaneously reinforces the perception that whatever attire it excludes is unprofessional. Ladies, fascinators, are modish and informal in comparison to hats that cover the top of the head. Septum rings are edgier than nose studs. A dress code can be Rosetta Stone to decode the meaning of attire. We can get a hint about how people understood an article of clothing by looking at the rules that allowed and prohibited it. Sometimes, dress codes are quite explicit about the meaning of the attire they regulate. For instance, some Renaissance-era dress codes said that red or purple symbolized noble birth, and others insisted that jewelry and sumptuous adornments were signs of sexual licentiousness. Moreover, these dress codes didn't just reflect pre-existing associations between clothing and social status, sexual morality, and political position. They also reinforced and at times even created those associations, changing the way people thought of those wearing a certain garment and how the people wearing it thought of themselves. Defining the social meaning of a garment can actually change the way it shapes individual self-image. For instance, remember that psychological experiment involving the white lab coat? It also found that people wearing an identical coat did not exhibit improved cognitive performance if they were told beforehand that it was a painter's coat instead of a lab coat. The Law of Fashion. In 1974, 1 year before he would become an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, John Paul Stevens wrote the following. From the earliest days of organized society, matters of appearance and dress have always been subjected to control and regulation, sometimes by custom and social pressure, sometimes by legal rules. Just as the individual has an interest in a choice among different styles of appearance, so also does society have a legitimate interest in placing limits on the exercise of that choice. The case, Miller v. School District No. 167, involved a public school teacher who wore a Van Dyke beard, a sort of abbreviated goatee shaped into a point at the chin, reminiscent of the Flemish painter Anthony Van Dyck, in violation of his school's dress code. The court opined that dress and hairstyles are matters of relatively trivial importance and rejected Mr. Miller's claim that the dress code violated his constitution.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?